This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome, and thank you for being here this afternoon. I am David Beal, director of the Davis Humanities Institute, co-convener of the Chancellor's Colloquium. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to this first event in the Chancellor's Colloquium Distinguished Speaker Series for 2013-2014. Now in its fifth season, the Colloquium Series continues the work of inviting public figures and renowned researchers to engage our campus community in compelling conversations around pressing issues of the 21st century. As in the past, our distinguished speakers this year encourage us to take a fresh look at the university as an incubator for innovation and help us reinvigorate our land-grant mission in a more global context. Now, our format this evening will begin with opening remarks by Dr. Young entitled "The University of California, Past, Present, and Future," followed by a brief discussion with Chancellor Katehi. Then the audience will be given an opportunity to ask their own questions of Dr. Young, moderated by our chancellor. Allow me first to introduce Chancellor Linda Katehi. Chancellor Katehi became the sixth chancellor of UC Davis in August 2009. As the university's chief executive officer, she oversees all aspects of the university's teaching, research, and public service mission. She also holds UC Davis faculty appointments in electrical and computer engineering and in women and gender studies. More than anything, she is recognized nationally and internationally as a compelling leader for higher education, the importance and value of scientific research, and she is also a passionate advocate for each and every one of our students. Please join me in welcoming our esteemed Chancellor, Linda Katehi. I am now honored to introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Chuck Young. Dr. Young is Chancellor Emeritus and Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Los Angeles. From 1968 to 1997, he served as Chancellor of UCLA, taking office at the age of 36, when most of the faculty is still trying to get tenure. Chancellor Young's inaugural pledge was to advance UCLA, quote, from the second level of good universities to the first rank of excellent universities. I might add that Chancellor Katehi and I both have degrees from UCLA at the time when Dr. Young was chancellor. Under his subsequent leadership, UCLA did indeed move into the elite company of the nation's finest research universities. His leadership at UCLA was distinguished by a commitment to excellence that pervaded every facet of campus life. Dr. Young is internationally recognized as a leader of higher education and is a former chairman of the prestigious Association of American Universities. He's also served on several national and international educational commissions, including those of the American Council on Education, the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges, and the Business Higher Education Forum. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Young. I turn the podium over to you now.
Speaking apparatus here, but I'll try to get it fixed. If not, I suspect you can probably hear me anyway, but they are, I think, taping this, so I better get it back on. Thank you very much, David, and thank you, Chancellor Katehi, for inviting me to come and participate in this excellent forum. David mentioned a lot of things that were in the program and that had to do with my time at UCLA. He didn't say much about the period before that, but I want to tell you just a couple of things. Number one is I taught at Davis in 1959-1960. That was the. Is this coming through now? That was the first year in which the Davis campus was a general campus. And at the time, the chancellor was Emil Marak. I had attended before that as an undergraduate at UC Riverside. I was in the first class there and had served as the president of the student body. Then going to UCLA and getting both my master's and doctoral degrees, serving as a teaching assistant and as a research assistant. There are things after UCLA, but we won't go into them now unless you want to talk about them. I'm very pleased to be here, as I've said, and I've had an opportunity today to revisit the campus, which I had not done in a long time. And I must say, it's not the Davis campus I remember from 1959 and 60. It is indeed a beautiful campus and a campus which is developing, as I've said earlier to a group, in, I think, a wonderful way. And I am very glad to have been associated with it in that early days and to continue to be associated with it now, including being here today for this event. I said when I was asked what I would speak about that I'd talk about the University of California, past, present, and future. I spend a lot of time thinking about the University of California, and for a lot of people, much too much time speaking about it. I have the ability to talk about things sometimes in ways that people don't like, and sometimes too long and too loudly, as far as other people are concerned. But I feel so strongly about the University of California and about the role it has played, is playing, and ought to be able to play in the future, and the way in which it can continue to be the kind of university it was in the past, that I cannot divorce myself from continuing to be involved in these discussions. Let me say a bit about the history of California and the history of the University of California. California had begun to wake up in the 20s and 30s a bit, especially in the 30s, when it came to be the home of motion picture industry, which was really its first major industry, other than farming, which has always been, I suppose, its major industry. Then during the war, during World War II, many things happened in California. It became the manufacturing home of much of the war material that was used in winning World War II. During that period, there was a substantial excess in terms of income over expenses, and a war chest was developed under Governor Earl Warren, which was then used to help launch the university off on a more rapid pace immediately after World War II. Now, when I speak of the university at that point in time, I'm really speaking primarily of the Berkeley campus, but UCLA was coming along, and Davis was at that point in time still the university farm. UC Riverside was the home of the Citrus Experiment Station, and of course the UC San Francisco Medical Center and facilities. But the University of California and California itself grew up together, and they fed each other. California could clearly could not have moved as rapidly and as well as it did without the succor of the University of California. And the University of California obviously could not have succeeded without the strong support of the state of California. And we went through several kinds of phases. First was after World War II, the defense industry, especially the airframe industry, and then the space industry, and then the biotech industry, and the tech industry generally. And these all were very much related to the University of California. If you look at where these various entities developed, they developed adjacent to the University of California campuses. Now, that's what happens nationally. It's what happens around the world. But it was especially true in California. And during that period of time, through one governor and another, but especially with Earl Warren, and then with Pat Brown, the university was extremely well supported. It was well understood. The members of the Board of Regents understood the university. The regents of the University of California were independent in their thinking and helpful to the university in every way possible. And the funds flowed increasingly to the university to enable it to do the things it needed to do to stay at the forefront of research and teaching to the great benefit of the state of California. Now, there were ups and downs. There were good budget years and bad budget years. There were cycles. Perhaps you'd have two or three good years and two or three bad years. But a bad year wasn't really bad, and a good year was pretty good. Until about the late 1970s, and then things began to change. And since that time, I think we've been pretty generally on a downward trajectory in terms of support from the state. Now, as your chancellor reminded me in a discussion at noon with a number of her colleagues, that is something that happened nationwide. While the University of California has suffered, the public universities across the country have suffered as well. And they've suffered long before there was a great recession, although they suffered more severely during that recession than they had previously. One of the things I want to say to you, and I hope to be able to at least convince you that this is something worth looking at, is that the economic problems of the state of California, and therefore the ability of the state of California to support its university, are structural. And they are not going to go away with the end of this great recession. They are structural for a whole range of reasons, but I will mention two, or perhaps three, two and a derivative or a cause that are extremely important. The first was the passage in 1978 of Proposition 13. Proposition 13, most people would say, was a proposition which made it possible for people who otherwise would have their property taxes rising so rapidly that they might not be able to stay in their homes, to stay in their homes. And I think if you asked 100 people, 99 people would say that's what it was. Those who would say anything. A lot would be like the people today who are saying that the Obamacare law is bad, but Affordable Health Care Act is good. And there would be a lot of people who would have the same kind of confusion about Proposition 13. Proposition 13 did two things which will be with this state until it is repealed, if it ever is. One is that it took away the ability of local government, including education, which was local school districts, to fund their operations from their own resources, which were primarily property taxes. And that meant that somebody had to pick up that expense. And the state of California picked it up. The state of California at that point in time, under the current governor in his first incarnation, had a surplus. And so they said, oh, well, we'll pick up the cost of the public schools. Well, the cost of the public schools is a very substantial obligation. And as the resources of the state began to wane, the ability to maintain the public schools began to get very difficult. Another thing that did is put the state into a situation in which its main source of income is a very inelastic one. The income tax, which rises and falls dramatically everywhere, but especially in California because of some of the peculiarities of its industry, and especially the effects of long-term capital gains on the ability of the state to have the revenues it needs. The second major problem was the is again another proposition which was passed in 10 years later, Proposition 98, which mandates that a certain percentage, about 48%, I think it is, of the state's general fund must go to the public schools. It not only said that, it said that when the state doesn't have enough money to fulfill that commitment in a given year, it creates an obligation on the state to repay the local districts that to pay at a later date what was not paid at that time. So the state at the present time has is in the situation in which an overwhelming percentage of its general revenues has to go to the public schools. The other thing, the other very important function, there are two others, but one that is especially difficult is the prison system. So if you look at the public schools and the prison system, the state has an obligation to spend almost all of its general fund revenues. So there's very little left for the three segments of higher education, but especially the University of California and the state college system. So we're in a situation in which it is going to be continue to be extremely difficult for those reasons. And I said I would mention a third, and that is the initiative process itself, which has gone far beyond what anyone ever intended it to be, and has come to a state in which almost anything can be passed by the public and an initiative if the people who want it passed have enough money to do so. And conversely, almost anything can be defeated. If you look at the most recent proposal to increase the tobacco tax, can be defeated if those who want it defeated have enough money to put up to do it. So that is always kind of hanging over us, and is something I think which needs to be looked at. But the thrust of my views about the funding from the state is that it is very unlikely. I would go farther than that, but I'll stop at that point and say very unlikely that the state of California will ever be able, once again, to provide the kind of funding it provided in the past, which allowed the University of California to grow and to grow in partnership with the state of California. So I think we need to look to a new way of funding the university, and I'll be happy to talk about that within our conversation and answer questions about it. It really means, in my opinion, becoming more self-sufficient, and as a part of that, getting the state to agree that it will remove some or many or maybe even all of the hurdles which it places in the way of the administration and faculty of the university to be able to run them the way they ought to be run for the benefit of the citizens of this state. I have one other point I want to just spend a minute or two on and then move on to the discussion, which is, I think, probably much more likely to be helpful and interesting than my own comments. And that is that it is high time for the University of California to understand that it needs to very substantially decentralize its operations. The University of California, people still talk about it as if it's one university. The University of California is a configuration It is of nine very excellent universities and a fledgling university coming along down the line. Six of its universities are members of the Association of American Universities, which is a club you don't join, but a club to which you get invited. And that means that these six universities are among the top 40 or 50, and they're really much better than that, 50 or 60, I guess I should say, top 50 or 60 major high-quality universities in the country. And I think we need to begin to look at the university as if that is really the case. And while we may want to continue talking about the University of California, in many respects, it's a fiction. It may be a very useful fiction, but I think we need to look at it that way. And that means that we need to look at how you manage a consortium of universities rather than a university with a group of campuses which needs somebody to look over them. The faculty and administration of UC Davis do not need somebody to look over them. They know how to run a university, and they do a damn good job of it. And what they need is some people in the Board of Regents and in the Office of the President to help all of the universities in this consortium gain funds from the state and work with the state and other agencies, including the federal government, to keep the relationships that it needs in proper perspective. It needs a Board of Regents which turns its attention to the development of policies for the campus and gets out of the business of doing the transactional things that need to be done on the campuses. And that means, I think, and I'll really end my comments there, that needs, in my opinion, the creation of a series of boards of trustees for each of the campuses, which by the Board of Regents, created by the board, with the appointments coming from the board, but on the recommendation of the chancellors of the several universities or campuses, and with those boards being delegated the authority to do the transactional business of the university, allowing the university and the Office of the President to turn its attention to policy, which it does not do now, but because it and they are so busy doing the transactional business that they love to do. What color should this building be? Should the assistant director of nursing at the hospital at Davis be paid $148,000 or $157,000, and so forth? And that's the way the Board of Regents spends its time. Rather than doing the sorts of things a board of directors of a university with many operating units similar to the arrangement of the University of California spends it. I've laid out some things about which a lot of people agree and a lot of people disagree, and that surely will be the case for you here. And Linda, I'm sure, will want to challenge me on some things, ask questions about others, and I look forward to the opportunity to answer your questions following that discussion.
Thank you, Chancellor Young, for your very nice comments, and Professor Bill, thank you also for your comments today. I would like to, what I plan to do is to ask you a few questions and try to follow on your comments and try to, so we help us learn a little more about your thoughts. And then we will open the questions to the audience and we'll try then to hear what your feedback, concerns, or suggestions we may have for you and for your comments as well, reaction to them. So let me just start by saying that, as you mentioned, public universities have seen tremendous political and economic pressures in the last few years and public scrutiny as well. So first question, is this a new reality for us? Has it happened in the past? If it's new, if it has happened in the past, what are the lessons from the past? If it is a new reality, How can we protect the university and protect specifically the UC quality? And what are the things we need to consider doing moving forward?
That's a big question. I'll try to answer it. First of all, let me say that one of the problems you have in advancing the kinds of things I advance is that despite all the problems that confront it, the university is doing very well. Mm-hmm. But I think it's doing very well because it has been forced to do what I have argued that it ought to do, and that is to, by and large, fend for itself. I'll leave it there. So it has found other ways to fund the great programs that it needs to provide. It's found it by increasing student tuition and other funds. It's found it by dramatic increases in support from federal contracts and grants and from private funds and from business operations that produce income back to the university. So I think the universities, the University of California and the others that we are very much like, need to move forward along those lines and recognize that that's where the money has come from increasingly over the years, and that's where it's increasingly going to have to come from in the future. A group of ex-chancellors, including Larry Vanderhoff, I think there were about 23 of us, met together in San Francisco 2 years ago, last June, I think it was, to discuss these issues. And President Udoff came and met with us for the better part of one morning. And we talked with him about the ideas which we were discussing and the conclusions we were reaching. And then we sent him a letter which said, we ought to do essentially what I have proposed and work with the state to get the state to provide its funds and not diminish them, but to provide them as student financial aid for California residents so that we could move ahead doing the things we needed to do, including increasing tuition, without coming to the point where we were in any way putting severe constraints on California student mm-hmm. as student admission to the university. So that I think that's really what needs to be done, and I think that's what's been done, but it has been done to us rather than doing it ourselves. And I think that's true at Michigan, Illinois, at Virginia, at all of the really high quality public universities across the country.
So one of the biggest challenges that we face as an institution is that we have found it difficult to walk away from what we have considered to be a fundamental value and mission for the institution, which is really to provide access to our students. And what has been difficult for us as a UC community is to really see tuition going, increasing in substantial ways, and as a matter of fact, in a way that has made us to be now one of the most expensive universities for our in-state students. And that has been an issue, of course, that has concerned us and many others. So when UCLA took a very strong position in supporting the Anderson School of Management into becoming more private, there was a lot of opposition from the faculty, primarily because the concern was that we are moving along a path that may be taking us away from the UC values. So what do you think? What are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think along with what I'm proposing, there needs to be a very strong commitment and reaffirmation of the fact that this university remains a public university. A public university in terms of its values, a public university in terms of the public that it serves. But in some respects, all major universities in the United States. There is, in many respects, even in funding, there's very little difference between Berkeley and Stanford, or UCLA and USC, or whatever. They receive a great deal of funding from the state through the Cal Grant program and in other ways, and they receive a huge amount of funding from the federal government in terms of Pell Grants and in terms of contracts and grants and other ways. But I think we need, the first thing you need is to say, despite the fact that we are becoming more self-sufficient, and we're clearly moving that down that track with our eyes open, rather than just being shoved down that track the way we have been for the last 25 or 30 years, that we remain a public institution and our dedication is to continue to do that. I understand the concern about increasing tuition, but I've studied the data pretty carefully. And my real concern about increasing tuition is that it might have, one would expect it would have, the effect of turning away California residents or others, but especially my concern there is California residents, who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, financially, socially, ethnically. That has not happened. That hasn't happened because the University of California has had an excellent student aid program. And I think all of the data that one can gather about tuition and student aid is that contrary to what might appear to be the case and what most legislators in most states think is the case, a high tuition, high financial aid system works out better in that regard than low tuition. And if you think about it, you can begin to understand why. The amount that's paid in tuition is a very small percentage of the total cost of education. And I don't just mean tuition and room and board and books and so forth, but if you look at the potential students from really disadvantaged areas, it is the loss of income that goes along with that. Yeah. Those people are not working for 4 years and making a contribution to the well-being of their families. So that's a real cost. So to say, well, you get tuition free helps primarily those who come from well-to-do families. They get free tuition at the University of California rather than paying what they would pay to go to Stanford. And they get an education that's just as good. So I think we need to be very, very careful. And the policy now, as I understand it, certainly was and I think still is, that one-third, at least, that one-third of the funds raised through tuition goes into financial aid, return to aid, My position is you return as much as you need to in order to maintain the accessibility to maintain accessibility to the university.
One of the solutions that was proposed by the state by various state legislators was last year was to rely more and more on online education and tools to increase the number of students who can then have access to our programs, and then second, to reduce cost. What are your thoughts on online and whether online education can impact us economically or whether not? And what do you think about online education and its impact on learning or delivery of materials, and also the role the campus then can play in the education of the students, being physically on a campus, could play in the education of students in the future?
I think online education is a very useful thing. I you know, I've been as was stated in my in the introduction, I've been at this a long time. I remember when the first distance universities in Britain were established, and people were telling me that's the wave of the future. The old-fashioned university with a campus is no longer going to be around. We're going to be doing distance education. And when online things came along, I was told the same thing, and I was told you don't really need libraries anymore. After leaving UCLA, I ended up being president of the University of Florida for 4 years. And my predecessor had reached that conclusion and didn't believe in libraries, and he left a library that was in shambles, and I had to rebuild it. What's happened is that libraries are getting more use today than ever. And that's in part because of the fact that the students and others are learning online and learning how much more there is to learn, and they're using the libraries as part of that. I think online education can be useful. I don't think I think in some, let's say, master's level professional programs, online education can be perhaps effective for the degree, but by and large, I believe online education ought to be supplemental to the regular instruction program and not replacing it.
Let us talk about the way a university has been able to change. I mean, this is, we know that universities, for all kinds of good reasons, have policies and processes that are not very easy to change in many ways, and then in some ways they slow the academy in trying to accept and implement new ways in many different areas. We have been criticized for this recently, obviously. We hear a lot across the board, and we see a lot of publications written about how slow higher education is to change, or how unwilling we are, specifically faculty, to accepting, if you like, or embracing change. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think the universities are slow to change. They are protectors of the body of knowledge. They are the repositories of history. The people who are teaching the students and managing the affairs of the universities see it as a long-range proposition. And therefore, they change slowly. But I think they've changed dramatically over a reasonable amount of time since, let's just pick since 1964, which was the start of the free speech movement. Universities today are dramatically different than they were then. And I was around. I was a vice chancellor at the time, working with those students. As a kind of a offhand, not an offhand, but as a comment, those students change the world, and those students change the universities in which they were of which they were a part, and the faculty grudgingly, to some extent, happily, to some extent, faculty have about as many different views as the public generally, went along with that change. And the universities today are much better universities than they were in the pre-1964 era. For that reason, and one of the main aspects of that is the fact that they have become diverse universities. Davis, UCLA, and Berkeley are more diverse today by far than they were. And the students who are here, whether they are from minorities or disadvantaged backgrounds or not, are much better educated than their counterparts were 30 years ago. So there is change, and I think we need to point out that there's change. You know, there are these notions that all faculty are very liberal and way off to the left. You know, there's some liberals and some conservatives. There are a lot more conservative faculty in engineering than there are in political science. But that's, and some people think that's something that's imposed. That's because they come from backgrounds and are interested in things which are much more attractive to people of that bent. Those who are on the liberal side, those on the conservative side come from that background as well. But universities change. They change slowly. Universities ought not to back and forth all the time. They ought to move reasonably in the right direction or in direction in which they're being, and then when things change, move back the other way. But I don't think they should be whipping back and forth at the whim of public policymakers, which they would like us to do, including a couple of public policymakers who attend Regents meeting.
Well, one last question for you, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. When I was a graduate student at UCLA, you were a beloved chancellor. All the students, I cannot speak about the faculty, I have to say, or about the staff, but I knew that the students really loved you. So, two things. One question for me specifically, what makes somebody so loved by the students? And then second, what kind of changes have you seen? You spoke a little bit to that just now about the students then and the students today, but have you noticed any specific changes in the student body that students we are receiving today in our campuses? And what do you think the new generation of students we are receiving, how do you think they will change the universities today in a way that we will speak about those 20 years later and say exactly what you said about how universities changed in the mid-60s?
I can't answer the question about why people liked me or didn't like me. I was around a long time, and they thought they were, you know, a lot of people thought, well, he isn't just one chancellor; he is the chancellor for forever and ever. And so that was probably a part of that. What do I think the students today are likely to create the kind of change the students did then? No, because there's not the. Look, there were serious problems. There are today, but there were serious problems in our society which were better seen by those students than anybody else. And you had the civil rights movement and then the Vietnam War coming together, coalescing in a way which made any able-bodied bright young person think something needs to happen, and they made it happen. And they, you know, I sat all night here. Steve Arditti here was there at the time, and we would sit up all night eating pizza with students, or eating pizza and talking to them, and. You know, we used to say, we'll do anything which ought to be done, but we won't do anything which ought not to be done. And we'll do what ought to be done even if someone demands it. And demanding something that ought to be done is not a bad thing. There's changes that need to be made today, which I wish the students would get a little more into. We're living it today, especially, I guess, because of what happened yesterday. But the things which are more, which were and would be more apparent to the students, have been changed enough that they've been institutionalized in a way.
Very good. So we have now time to ask for questions from the audience, and let's start.
There's one there in the back.
Yes, it's very hard to see from here.
Thank you. Chancellor Young, I find your comments about decentralizing the university very intriguing. I have a two-part question about that. One part is a question of clarification. I detect in your comments that you're not proposing or suggesting a complete decentralization of the university, but simply more autonomy for the individual campuses in which the current system of the relationship on budget matters to the state centralized still holds true. The second question I have is whether or not there are any other models in other public university systems in other states that might be useful for us in that regard.
The answer to the first question is, yeah, I don't advocate splitting up the university. I advocate changing the view from one university to a consortium of universities that stays together and works together, because it is in each of their best interests to stay together and work together. And that would have an executive body probably substantially smaller than it is at the present time, that continued to do the things which that consortium needed to have done for it, or could better have done for it than to try to do it individually. And, that'd take, if somebody moved down that line, you'd have to start parsing out this function and that function and the other function. But I think it would still, at least for a long period of time, be useful to have a single budget presentation to the state. I think it ought to be put together differently than it is now. I think it ought to be put together from the bottom up rather than more bottom up rather than top down. Are there other examples? Partial examples. I think that there's some things about the University of North Carolina system that are useful to look at. There's some things about the SUNY system that are useful to look at. I think some things are happening in Wisconsin that are useful to look at. Although I'm not a great fan of it in general, I think there's some things in the University of Florida, in the Florida universities system, that are useful to look at. But, a group of wise people ought to be put together, if you're going to move in that direction, put together, and including some internal and some external people, and asked to look at all the things that go on. How should we do this? What should be here and what should be there? Who should be there? Who should be here? How should things be put together? Et cetera.
Thank you. There was a question right there. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor Young. I was one of the fortunate individuals who could attend UCLA at a time when you paid no tuition. And I realize that from what you've said, the significant increases in tuition, notwithstanding what you would think, does not contribute to a lack of diversity. And there's still opportunity for disadvantaged to attend. But there's so much being written today about the growing inequality that exists in our society. A very well-to-do 1% and almost a caste system at the bottom. And it seems to me the University of California campuses are very focused on growth and advancement in technology. I don't see, and I wonder what your thoughts are on, can the universities play any role at all in doing something about this inequality that's growing in our society?
Well, I think higher education generally, university education, should be a major tool in dealing with that problem. It can't, but it's as large as it is, it's still small compared to the larger problem. But that is, in my opinion, the major issue, social issue we face today. If you look at what's happened, and it's only in the last 25 years that this has occurred, you've got this kind of situation occurring. And matter of fact, there's some indication that this one may not be going up, but leveling or going down. That is the 99% and the 1%, or the 95% and the 5%, whatever, however you want to break it down. I don't want to get down to arguing about how many angels there are on the head of a pin on this issue, but that's a serious problem. I think that's the problem brought about the French Revolution. You know, that I think we're seriously in that ballpark. But it is poo-pooed. And I hope we're educating a group of students who don't want to see that poo-pooed. They want it dealt with. Talk about getting admission to the University of California, getting admission to the middle class has become almost out of the question. Everybody loves the middle class, but they're keeping people from getting into it. So I think universities ought to play a very substantial part in that. I think faculty ought to play a substantial part in it. I think students ought to begin to understand that and try to do something about it. I think they are. I think they understand. But I think it's the most difficult problem this country faces today. And it is the differences are phenomenal. Phenomenal. If you looked at just three or four weeks ago, the current billionaire list came out. There are more billionaires now than there were millionaires 15 years ago in the United States. And I mean 100, you know, $75 billion. And it's not the amount of money they have, but the amount you earn. When the person who runs a company earns 50 times what the person who's making the product earns, there's something wrong. And then to pour salt in the wound, the person making the 50 times gets to report that as capital gains and pays 15% on it, while the person working on the line pays 30% on it, something is wrong. And I think we better turn our minds to doing something about it. Thank you for asking that question. Yes, well, you.
Yes, here. So there were two questions, and maybe we can start there, you are the third one. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome. You mentioned that education was so much better now than 30 years ago, a little earlier in your talk. And just a moment ago, you mentioned since the 80s, there's been this big change. I went back to school as an adult in the 60s, in the Bay Area and here at UC Davis in the 70s. And I question your comparison, because in the 60s and throughout the 70s, there was this revolution that, especially in the Berkeley area, was intent on destroying the structure of all things traditional, and certainly education. The entire slant and philosophy of teaching changed. The students wanted to desecrate the structure, wanted it to be made more liberal, and they succeeded in that. That was a real revolution. You didn't go to school and see a professor in a coat and a nice plaid shirt. You went to school and you saw the professors in ragged jeans and headbands and scruffy beards, which has become the norm today. But in 1959, it was an entirely different looking campus, and the structure of education had been formalized into a tradition. And those traditions, in my opinion, have been completely depleted. My question to you, do you feel in suggesting that the education is better today than 30 years ago, do you feel that there might be a welcome change in formality and in structure that students finally are able to grasp that that is the better way to bring about change?
The students in the 60s and early 70s, and I'm, if I said the 80s, I was wrong. It really goes back. The roots are in the 60s and the 70s. What I was referring to is the time in which we really began to get serious about and find results from diversity. But going back to what and what you said, the students, like others who have seen wrongs and tried to right them, overplayed their hand. I mean, that I think that's probably the way revolutions occur. I think they to make a point, they make it bigger than it is. They railed about things that they didn't need to rail about, and they got some reactions which caused some substantial changes for a while. The educational process was in danger for a period of time, I think, through reconstitution, it was called at the time, reconstituting the educational program, changing grading. I mean, there was a feeling that everybody was getting A's now because the faculty were afraid to give them B's or whatever. I don't know what. And there clearly was some of that. And that's probably, again, reaction, action, reaction. That probably happened in Egypt. That probably happened, who knows what happened in Iraq. But it happened then. I think today, now faculty tend to dress differently today than they did then. Students dressed. They, at the University of Florida, when I met with students, they always wore suits. I said, I told them, I didn't know a student at UCLA who had a suit. And the student body officers would always come to meet me in suits. Faculty dressed differently. Students dressed differently. But my guess is if you look at a civil engineering class or an electrical engineering class or at a class in Jewish history or at a classics class, the class is probably being taught about the same way it was before 1964, and the data that they're dealing with is probably about the same. I think it's being probably done a little better because people have learned a lot. And when I say better in the sense I meant it before, I meant because of the environment in which the learning is occurring. Students attending classes at Davis today who are sitting next to African Americans, Chicano Latinos, Asian Americans, learn things they didn't learn before. And that's a part of the educational process. I learned as much from my colleagues when I was a student, especially as a graduate student, as I did from the faculty. And I suspect most of you did too. And it's very important. The lawyers who are graduating from Davis today are better lawyers than they would have been in that old situation. The teachers are better teachers than they would have been because they have been in a society that is like that society out there, not the sea of white male faces that before 1958 at the University of Florida was all there was. White male. That's not too long ago. So there's been a substantial transformation in our society and in our educational programs. I don't know how many of you have seen The Butler, but I went to see it not really knowing how much it was going to get to me and how much it was going to get to that experience. If you haven't seen it, see it and think about it.
Very good. There is another question here, if we can. And then, yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Chancellor Young, thank you so much for being here and sort of nerding out and geeking out about UC policy. It's really a pleasure to listen to you. I'm hoping you can take us back to 1968, because it seems to me that it's a really... your appointment at such a young age is a very California story, which is this entrepreneurial risk of the scions of industry, the regents. They pick a young professor, and they give him the keys to what's perhaps the Chevrolet, not quite the Cadillac yet, at UCLA. And you're able to serve 20-plus years. These days, we're told we're trapped in an arms race for higher ed administrators, and we have to pay them $500,000 a year to be the president of the University of California, $400,000 a year to be a UC chancellor. If we have to change the way the regents sort of govern over the system, do we also have to change perhaps the way we govern our campuses? Is there a different model that might work?
I think the model's pretty good. I have some funny notions about things. You've already found that out. We were talking earlier with a group, and we were talking about athletics, and I said athletic salaries have gotten, and I'm a big fan of athletics, gotten way out of line. Paying coaches $10 million or $8 million is nonsense. It's antithetical. It's wrong. It's morally wrong, in addition to being wrong for a lot of other reasons. I think that to some extent there's too much emphasis on what you have to pay to university administrators. I don't know if $400,000 is too much. I made about $190,000, I think, or something like that. But that was a long time ago, and I don't know if you upgraded that figure to the cost of living. But they were too low earlier on. I think when I first became chancellor, I got $27,000 a year. So they were a little on the low side. In some places, they're a little on the high side, I think, at the present time. I certainly think the just retiring president of University of Ohio, or Ohio State, excuse me, the Ohio State, I think it was making much too much money. The system of administration and of faculty appointment and promotion and of development of curriculum and admissions and the academic enterprise on the campuses of the University of California, by and large, I think works extremely well. One of the problems is that in the search for presidents, and I'm not talking about the current president. There's nothing here intended to be negative about the new president. And indeed, what I'm going to say wouldn't apply anyway. Two things. One, I'm going to introduce another thing I'm bothered by. The search process is badly done. There's Larry Vanderhoff, I see back here. Larry was a superb chancellor of this university. Now, I was on the board of Intel for 30 years, and I've been on a couple of other. I tried to get not do that too much because I think it's being overdone by a lot of people. But I was on the board of Intel for 30 years. That's a great institution with great people. At Intel, when Andy Grove decided to leave the presidency and become chairman, who do you think was the primary person trying to pick his successor? Andy Grove. Larry Vanderhoff should have been one of the primary people picking his successor. But the process is all screwed up. Setting that aside for the moment, if I can. You fill these positions with people who come from as presidents from other universities or provosts from other universities, and especially like the presidency of the university. And they think that job is the job they had writ large. And it ain't. It's a different job. But they come in, I'll do what I used to do. I'll worry about appointment of, all these things which they get their hands into and mess up. And to some extent that's true, I think, of some appointments at presidents of universities or chancellors of universities. Quite often you're not looking at the right things. Okay. This lets me play my hobbies. With my hobbies.
There was a question down there. Yes, the gentleman with the yellow shirt. Thank you.
Do you think that the contribution of the University of California to the state and to society in general is appreciated by the people of the state and by our legislature? And if not, do you have any suggestions in that regard?
No, I don't, and I think we've done a very bad job of getting that message across. It's become increasingly hard as California has grown. The number of people who come from the university has out there in important things has dropped dramatically. Used to be all the people that really counted were graduates of the University of California. Now there's very, very small numbers of those people. So I don't think that's something that the Office of the President and the Regents ought to work on, and I don't think they spend much time on it. And when they do slick kinds of things and put it out. And that's a tough job, and I think that needs to be said. People need to understand how this economy and how this society has benefited from what the university does and how it will benefit from what it needs to do in the future. That's a major function of the central authority, whatever it is, and the kind of university organization I see in the future.
Yes. Go ahead with this question, and then we have one more up here.
Chancellor Young, you were my chancellor when I was at UCLA for 17 years. One of the things you did, as Dr. Katehi asked you, but you couldn't answer her question, is we did all love you, and you were a great chancellor. But one of the things you did do is really developed a sense of community spirit at UCLA, which then has led many of us to give our support back to UCLA, both with our presence as well as financial support. How would you suggest that the university's campuses of the University of California engender their student populations when they leave to be loyal and give both philanthropic support and also create opportunities for the graduates of their campuses to then give back to the campus that they came from?
Well, the first thing they ought to do is make sure that that the experience the students are getting at the university is a good one, and they go away with a good taste in their mouth, not a bad taste. But not just a good taste, a great taste. And I think the university does that to a very large extent. I've heard those kinds of things about what's happening here very, very clearly. And then you need to involve students, and you need to get them to understand early on that they have a lifetime relationship with that university, and a part of that relationship is giving back in one way or another. UCLA now raises more money than any other public university in the country. And it's right up there every year in the top 10 with all the privates. But if you make a comparison to the number of alumni, percentage of alumni who give, it's not even in the ballpark with the privates. And that's true of all the publics. And so there's something there that is broad that needs to be dealt with. I wish I knew how to deal. Something I talk about with the vice chancellor for public affairs, development, alumni, and so forth at UCLA very regularly. And she's always saying, "Look here, Chuck. Look at this. Why is this?" I said, "I don't know. We need to change it." But that's true here. I'm sure it's true at Berkeley. It's true at Michigan. It's true. At public universities generally, and it's got to be changed. I don't know how to change it, but I know one. The thing you got to start with, you got to make them believe their relationship with that university was a good one. They had a great experience, and they are better in every way for having gone there than they would be if they hadn't. And if you start with that base, then it seems to me there must be other things that can be done to help fix that problem.
There was one question up here. Thank you.
I noticed that you spent some time in Qatar, and I know that several U.S. universities have established a presence in Qatar: Cornell, Texas A&M, Carnegie Mellon, Northwestern. And I wonder what advice you would give to UC Davis and the UC campuses in general in thinking about building these bridges internationally and establishing a presence overseas.
One of the things I had responsibility, I was president of the Qatar Foundation, which is that's the Emir and the Sheikh of Moses funding. But Qatar is very different. It's a course of a different color. It is about as different from most of the rest of the Arab states as you can imagine, including UAE. But I had responsibility for that entity, and it included Weill Cornell Medical School, Virginia Commonwealth University, Texas A&M, Carnegie Mellon, et cetera. There are a couple more. Wisconsin came along toward the end. That's an amazing. When I first asked me to do, I said, "What is this you're doing? This will work." But it did. It worked. Each of these universities is asked to come in and create a college that is, for all practical purposes, identical to the college at home. by all practice, you, a lot of those early developments, people went in and took responsibility and went out and hired faculty to go over and run it. They have to be faculty from the institution. Now, you may hire them, but you don't hire them to Weill Cornell Medical School Qatar. You hire them to Weill Cornell Medical School with all the rights and privileges of all the other faculty and under the same terms and conditions. The admissions are the same. The courses are the same. The deans who were there running them told me in almost every instance the students at Qatar were a little cut above the students, and the process was a cut above the home process. If you could get involved in, and then there are a couple of other programs of that kind around the world that are really top flight, and if you had an opportunity to do that, I think it would be a great experience. The Qatar Foundation builds the facilities, pays all the costs, and pays you a fee for managing it. And it's doing great. I think they're doing great things. But a lot of them don't work out that way. But there are some that are very good. And I think that's a great way for American universities to provide service on an international basis.
Thank you. Yes, there was one question down there and then one up here. Thank you.
Chancellor Young, you indicated that you had talked about intercollegiate athletics previously in your discussions on the campus. I would be curious to hear your thoughts and wisdom. I know as a former member of some prestigious NCAA committees and leadership in that organization, as well as a leader in the Knight Commission, which has great oversight and studies intercollegiate athletics, what your thoughts are in terms of the role of intercollegiate athletics, recreation, and sports on a campus when we are talking about pretty dire economic times on campuses. And your campus at UCLA was a great model, and I think the work that you did in the Knight Commission and the NCAA were shining examples of things that could be done. Not sure where we are today in that area, but would be curious to see what your thoughts are and your wisdom in terms of where we are maybe going forward on this campus.
I came up today at lunch with a lot of the administrators, a lot of top administrators, and we had lunch together. I think intercollegiate athletics, let's take UCLA. I think UCLA could not have succeeded as well as it did without the base of intercollegiate athletics, which was there in started in the 30s. It could not have succeeded as well without it as it did with it. Now, could it still have done a good? Yes. But a strong, honest, socially conscious athletic program is a great boon to the development of a campus. And beyond it is a great boon to the campus. It's glue which helps hold the campus together. There's a lot wrong with intercollegiate athletics. It's gone wild financially. It's gone wild in terms of commercialism. It's gone wild in terms of building $500 million stadiums and things of that nature. And it ought to be contracted somewhat. At the extremes, it ought to be contracted. Coaches shouldn't be earning $6-8 million a year. Athletic directors shouldn't be earning $1.5 million or $2 a year. But baseball players shouldn't be earning $85 million. And chairman of boards of corporations shouldn't be making $35-40 million. So that maybe that's a problem with our society. But there are serious problems in the intercollegiate athletic program that need to be resolved. I don't think they're going to be resolved, and I'm about to tell my colleagues after 22 years as the only surviving founding member of the Knight Foundation Commission that I'm tired of of equivocation. On the other hand, I think a strong program, I think UCLA's program, but then UCLA had, there was some things that made it special. In the 1930s, Jackie Robinson, Washington, I mean, if Washington, Ralph Bunch played basketball at UCLA. So it did some things which put it on the map. It got strong national, got it known nationally at a time when it was helpful for it to be known, and helped it do some other things. And it still is. I mean, I was asked today, what about the faculty? What do the faculty think? Faculty. There are some who like it and some who don't like it and some who are kind of stupid about it on both ends. But if you go to Pauley Pavilion and see who's sitting in the stands, the most consistent fans in Pauley Pavilion over the years have been the faculty and staff. And I think it can and should make a great difference if it's run right, correctly, and if you keep the financial side of it in control. I think it's appropriate for student fees to go into the athletic program because the students benefit from it, and they get admission to games and things like that for it. But I don't think the university ought to put any of its general fund money into it. I think it ought to be self-sustaining in that regard.
There is a question up front here. Thank you.
First of all, Chancellor, thank you for being here. Thank you, Chancellor Katehi, for hosting this. As someone who began learning at your feet, Chancellor, at UCLA, and thanks to you wound up working the capital trenches in the university's behalf subsequently, I'm going to turn to a couple of observations you made and try to stitch them together just a bit more closely. One thing you said was that the primary duty of the president of the university is to be working externally to build support for the university and to try to head off unwelcome intervention. And I believe that passionately. I think that the people who are chancellors are brilliantly qualified to hire faculty and establish academic programs, raise funds locally and all that. But the president is key to that external role. So that's the first point I agree with completely. The second observation you made was that for some reason or other, our students, as they become alumni, are not doing nearly as much, at least in fundraising, as we would hope that they would. And that's true statistically. But I think the other thing we need to recognize, too, is that with all the forces at work in the political arena, forces that either want to drive resources to things other than the university, forces that want to browbeat the university into doing things that it should never be forced to do, we need much more help from our alumni, friends, and supporters in driving that message home. And, you can have the most brilliant argument in the world. You can have the most cordial relationships with policymakers. You can bring the faculty in. You can do all kinds of things. But when they're being beat on by somebody who gave them $50,000 in their last election, or listening to our pleas and our intellectual arguments, it's often just not a contest. And so somehow or other, part of the president's job, but also the chancellor, and Chuck, you pioneered some of this at UCLA, Chancellor Katehi, you're doing a great job here at Davis. But we need those people who are our alums, who are the titans of industry and all kinds of newspaper publishers and everybody else to be helping lean on those policymakers to do the right thing. Otherwise, we're not going to make it on our own. I mean, when I first started doing this, you could actually walk into a committee hearing and prepare your testimony very carefully, bring the right witness. People would actually listen, and they would decide what to do on the basis of what went on in that committee hearing. That almost never happens today. These things all just get kind of backroom decided on the basis of various forces. So that I hope that we can think a little bit about this continuum of, A, make sure that our students leave with a good, very good taste, and that we can find ways to get them to help us both in the private fundraising, which is now so vital as, for reasons you've cited, the public goes down, but also helping us with those public decision makers. Otherwise, we're not going to get there in terms of getting the resources and beating back the destructive intervention. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. My primary focus and teaching and research, to the extent I was able to stay at it, was the legislative process. And at the time, I was working with the California legislature and Congress. The California legislature was the best deliberative body in the world. It's now probably, next to the United States Congress, among the worst. And that's another thing we've got to somehow repair. And there ought to be a lot of lessons that we have learned from what it used to be and what it is now that's made it that way. And one of the things is lobbying. You know, I guess I'm not surprised that legislators can be bought. I'm surprised that they can be bought for so little. But we've got to take up arms on a lot of fronts, and that's one we've got to take up arms.
Well, with that, we would like to conclude this session. We would like to thank you, Chancellor Young, for being here with us and for sharing your experiences and your thoughts on higher education, but more specifically on the University of California. I would also like to remind you that our next speaker in this series is Dr. Hamid Dabashi, a professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, and he's going to be with us on January 14, 2014, to talk about yet another interesting topic, and I would like to invite you for that lecture as well. So with this, I would like to invite everyone to the lobby for a small reception, and then there is an opportunity to speak with Chancellor Young and ask him some more questions. I know there are a lot of things we like
about to run
hear
out of
him.
Answers, I think.
Not really, I have to say. But there is so much to learn from your experiences. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.